If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said yesterday that the White House is not considering conducting lie detector tests to uncover the author of the anonymous op-ed published in the New York Times. Because putting a lie detector in the White House would be like putting a smoke detector in Willie Nelson's dressing room.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to actress Emma Thompson, who also takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
President Trump is demanding an investigation into last week's anonymous op-ed, warning about his mental fitness and slamming the author of a new book about the chaos at his White House. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. One of the weirdest aspects of having Donald Trump as president is the fact that every few months or so, people working at the highest levels of government have to put down everything they're doing and hunt for the anonymous mole who just called the president a brain-dead moron. Same thing over and over. Someone calls the president an idiot, or they call him a fifth grader, or they leak a transcript of him telling the president of Mexico he wants a piñata for his birthday. And then serious government officials and four-star generals have to issue so many denials, they start to sound like Shaggy.
Wasn't me.
And sure enough, the government is once again grinding to a halt as the president demands that the attorney general use actual law enforcement resources to investigate who wrote last week's anonymous op-ed in the New York Times.
President Trump is now calling on Attorney General Jeff Sessions to track down that unnamed senior official behind that scathing New York Times editorial.
Do you think Jeff Sessions should be investigating who the author of the op-ed piece was or who some of these people are talking to?
Because I think it's national security. Yeah, I would say Jeff should be investigating who the author of that piece was, because I really believe it's national security.
We're going to take a look at what he had, what he gave, what he's talking about, also where he is right now.
He sounds like Sherlock Holmes after a concussion.
My dear Watson, we're going to find out who the suspect is and where he is and what he did and who he what and why I wear.
So Trump apparently thinks a crime might have been committed by whoever wrote the op-ed. Yesterday, White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway was asked on CNN what exactly that crime might be and didn't have an answer.
President Trump has said that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, should be investigating who the author of the piece is because of national security reasons. Is that a directive to DOJ to investigate?
So from what I understand, there can be an investigation if there is criminal activity, perhaps.
And there doesn't appear to be any.
I don't know that, and I don't think you know that. In other words, that's...
What would the criminal activity be?
It really depends on what else has been divulged by an individual. Anybody who would do this...
But we read the op-ed. There are no national secrets to
anybody who would do this, you don't know what else they're saying.
Do you think the person broke the law?
I don't know. I have no idea.
You think that because he or she wrote the op-ed, he or she might have also broken the law.
I have no idea what I have. No, I have literally no idea, nor do you.
Yeah, we do. We do, because we all read the op-ed. There are no crimes in there. It's called I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration, not I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration and Also I Murdered a Guy. The fact is, calling Donald Trump an incompetent moron is not a crime. It's not even new information. And yet, he's very obviously freaked out by both the anonymous op-ed and famed journalist Bob Woodward's blockbuster new book, Fear. He brought it up repeatedly last week and tweeted obsessively about it again this morning.
Quote, the Woodward book is a joke, he tweeted. Just another assault against me in a barrage of assaults using now disproven, unnamed, and anonymous sources. Many have already come forward to say the quotes by them, like the book, are fiction. Dems can't stand losing. I'll write the real book.
Please do that. I would love to see you try to write a book by yourself without a ghostwriter. And I mean a real book, not one of your airport books, because I'm pretty sure those books have exactly one word on each page. I'm talking an actual book with chapters and an appendix. Of course, if you told Trump you need an appendix, he'd probably say, fine, just take Eric's. I gotta say, I love imagining Trump sitting at a typewriter, punching away at the keys with his stubby meat paws. He either types one finger at a time, grandpa style, or with palms fully open like he's playing whack-a-mole. Sad. Exclamation point. Trump has spent the last week fixated on these anonymous leaks from inside his own White House, warning the country that he's erratic and unstable. So he's responding by going on national TV and acting erratic and unstable.
The latest act of resistance is the op-ed published in the failing New York Times by an anonymous, really an anonymous, gutless coward.
Who do you think it was? Maybe it's the same person who replaced your denture adhesive with Silly Putty? Anonymous. But it's not surprising to me that Trump wouldn't know how to pronounce the word anonymous, since he's never done anything anonymously in his life. If he had been the gossip girl, he would have signed the notes XOXO Donald J. Trump. But this is one of the most surreal aspects of the moment we're in. The president of the United States regularly has to go on TV and try to convince people that he's not out of his mind. In fact, last week, he just straight up asked his supporters to tell him that he's good at his job.
I beat all these senators, all these governors, all these brilliant political minds. Then I beat the other side. And then I listen, is he competent? I think I'm pretty competent, right? Don't you think so?
As a general rule, it's never good when you're the president and you have to go on TV and ask your supporters, do you think I'm competent? If I was about to go under and my surgeon said to me, do you think I'm competent? I'd say, you know what? I'll keep the gallstones. Trump also argued that years from now, his speeches would be viewed favorably by history, drawing a parallel with Abraham Lincoln that made absolutely no sense.
You know, when Abraham Lincoln made the Gettysburg Address speech, the great speech, do you know he was ridiculed? He was ridiculed. He went up to Gettysburg and he delivered that speech, the Gettysburg Address, and he was excoriated by the fake news. They had fake news. He was excoriated. They said it was a terrible, terrible speech. They said it was far too short. It's not long. Many of us know it by memory.
No. You do not know the Gettysburg Address by memory. I doubt you know your own address by memory.
It's, yeah, three large pizzas. It's a White House. It's just a big White House.
So now Trump's White House is engaged in an aggressive attempt to hunt down and expose the leakers in his government who think he's out of his mind, and they've reportedly considered some extreme measures.
Advisors to the president are considering all their options, including the idea of a lie detector test.
You want Trump staffers to take lie detector tests? That thing's gonna start freaking out as soon as you get inside the building. Bringing a lie detector test inside this White House is like bringing a Geiger counter to Chernobyl. All right, let's start with you, Kellyanne. Let's start with you, John Kelly. Yeah, you know what? Let's just start with the president. We have a paranoid president who's demanding investigations of his critics. If you were looking for the constitutional crisis, it's here, and it's being aided and abetted by people whose names we don't even know. People who are...
anonymous.
This has been a closer look. Our guest tonight is an Academy Award and Emmy-winning actress you know from Love Actually and Sense and Sensibility. She's currently starring in The Children Act, which is now available exclusively on DirecTV and in theaters this Friday. Please welcome to the show, Emma Thompson, everyone.
I'm exhausted.
Delight to have you here.
Thank you very much. And I'm thrilled to be here.
I want to congratulate you as well. You received an order. Am I saying this right? An order of the British Empire?
Yes. Dame Commander of the British Empire.
Dame Commander.
Yeah.
That's something else.
Yeah.
I've
become much more commanding since it happened.
Yes.
So that little bow in that clip, you know, where you see everyone doing that, I've got everyone in the family doing that now.
Oh,
and
wow.
I've also had every seat I sit on just slightly made slightly taller.
Just, you know, a so small elevation.
It's subtle.
Yes.
It's subtle. So people are slightly, you know, just lifting their heads slightly more towards me than they did before, but they're not quite sure why.
Yes. So this isn't a situation where they say, oh, Emma's changed. She's sitting in the big chair. You do it so subtly that
they'll never know.
That's really something else. Mm. So you would say that it has effectively gone to your head. You're willing to accept that.
Effectively. Yeah, I am. I'm willing to accept that.
As far as your honors in your life, is it right up there? Was it a moment where you thought, this is really something?
Well, actually, it's quite interesting because they send you a letter saying, will you accept it? But you can choose not to. You can choose to say, well, of course, we don't have an empire anymore, thank God, because it was ghastly, colonial, racist, dreadful, dreadful undertaking on every level. And actually have some moral principle about it. Or you can be like me and think, it's going to be a really nice badge.
Yeah. Hard to say no to a badge.
It's hard to say no to a badge.
A good badge.
Come on.
So hard to find a good badge these days.
Absolutely. And the Queen, you know, she'll have a little handbag in which I happen to know she keeps dog biscuits.
Is that I know she's truly a great lover of dogs, so...
She does. She'll open her handbag, take out a dog biscuit. I've seen this. And do like that, and the corgis roll over.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that you can reach an elevated place and still think there's nothing better than watching a dog roll over.
Yeah, it makes you really
you never
like
outgrow
her.
That.
Yeah, it makes you love her, I know.
I want to talk about this film, but I'm very excited. You have a film coming up that is Mindy Kaling wrote called Late Night, where you play a late night talk show host.
Yes.
Did you enjoy being part of this world, even fictionally?
I did. I thought I could get into this. And my studio was a little bit like this. My audience weren't nearly as good as you guys. Yeah. But, you know...
By the way, you pandered to them so well. I think you'd be very good at this job.
I'm good at ingratiating myself with people. I loved it. I really did love it. I got a kind of feel for it. And because I have such admiration for you guys, I mean, it's a very hard job. Night after night, you have to, enthuse. And that's not easy. I mean, sometimes it's
easier
not,
than you think.
You know,
it's...
you can't say, really?
Yeah.
You can't do this very poor film that you're in which you're not very good. How were you attracted to the role? I mean, you know, can't say things.
Well, those were
like
all
that.
Questions I was about to ask you, so now you've really put the rest of this interview in jeopardy.
Damn
did
it.
You did you speak to any talk show hosts before you did it?
Well, I didn't really, actually.
Good. I'm glad because I know you didn't talk to me and I would have been very insulted.
I felt I didn't need to because I've done so many talk shows.
Yeah.
And I tell you what I did do. I watched a lot of old talk show, because she would have because she's my age, she's like late 50s, so she would have grown up with, as I did, you know, the first talk show I did was with Johnny Carson.
Did you really?
Yes.
Wow.
I was dressed like a geography teacher. I had no idea about glamour. and Jimmy Carter was on at the same time. He was so nice.
That is a real, you really hit the jackpot for your first talk show.
I know, it was such fun.
Yeah. My first talk show was someone canceled on Conan O'Brien and they called me like an hour beforehand. For real.
Were you appearing as a guest?
I was a guest, They said, somebody canceled, will you come up and play a pizza box? No, they really did say, will you come up and... But that was because we were in the building. He was here. And so if they ever had last minute cancellations, they would just basically ring up and the first person who answered, they'd say, come down. Huh. It was a big deal. Mm. The first time, it wasn't Jimmy Carter or anything like that, but... This round goes to you.
Yeah.
So you play a judge in this film. Did you speak to judges? Did you spend time in the court?
Yeah, it was absolutely fascinating because I don't think you have it here, but it's the family court. Mm-hmm. And of course, the family court, because it's about the most important thing in the world, is considered rather less than the criminal court. So it's a slightly poor cousin. But of course, when you sit in the courtrooms, you realise that these people are presiding over life and death and watching terrible pain and suffering, and she's presiding over a case about a Jehovah's Witness boy who's refused a blood transfusion. But at the same time, Stan Tucci, her husband, has just thrown a hand grenade into the marriage and said, I'm going to have an affair. So it's all about her balancing herself. And it's Ian McEwan, so it's very, very interesting and sort of complicated and human. You know, there's no black and white, there's no goodies and baddies. It's all the grey areas of our lives where we get totally confused and don't know what to do.
It's a fantastic part. I also noticed, of course, you have to play piano in the film.
Yeah.
Is that, and you have to play some pretty serious piano, not just joking around piano. Do you have skills as a pianist?
Yeah, I mean, I can play the piano, but I had to learn this so that I could play it live. We didn't pre-record or anything like that. So my family threatened to throw me out because I rehearsed so much over 6 months. So in the end, I went to rehearse in a piano shop on the Fulham Road. And it was a big glass thing and I would be playing the piano and people would be outside looking in at the piano, wondering about whether perhaps to purchase it, and perhaps also wondering whether I came with it in some way. And I might have gone with some of them, actually. They were.
So wait, these are people just walking down the street?
Yes.
It's very alluring.
Luring.
Very alluring.
Yeah,
because usually on my first dates, I would both have to find someone to go on the date with and find a pianist. So if you can get both at once.
Yes, that's
did
it.
You, yes. So people were just walking by and saying, oh, is that Emma Thompson in the window?
I don't know whether they were thinking that, actually.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that particularly,
but
it was
odd. It
seems
like there's somewhere between Home, where you were kicked out for playing. There seems like there's other options other than in the window of an actual piano shop.
I'll tell you why, though, because it was a really posh piano, and I had to play that piano.
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah. So it was all just, I had to. There was no, I had no other choice.
All right, well, obviously, I take back my earlier criticism.
Yeah, don't. Yeah, don't even try. Yeah.
Your husband is an actor.
He is.
He was in The Crown, first couple seasons of The Crown.
Yes.
Do you feel like for all British actors, like, a Dame Commander's one thing, obviously, that's a great accomplishment, but that you also have to be in shows about the royal family, like, that's the true thing to aim for?
I did play the Queen once, actually.
You did
but
play the
not
Queen.
Well. Not well. It was about that moment. Do you remember that bloke broke into Buckingham Palace and sat on the edge of her bed and told him her life story?
Yeah.
His life story. It was that. But I mean, I watched it and I thought, I think other people have done it better. I mean, everyone's in The Crown. Everyone.
Yeah.
It's and I wasn't asked to be in it. And I feel a bit twisted about it. But, you know, look, I'll have my revenge in some way.
I think we're all looking forward to that.
Absolutely.
We're all looking forward to that. Now, a part you obviously played with great skill, which was fantastic, is Nanny McPhee, which I've heard you say is your favorite part. Is that true, that it's your favorite part that you've played?
It sort of is,
That's wonderful. It's so such a unique thing, and now you're trying to adapt it as a musical, Nanny McPhee.
I am.
No. That sounds to me like a very arduous thing to undertake.
Yeah, there was some famous musical producer who once said, if Hitler's alive, I hope he's out of town and working on a new musical. Because it's just hell, because you just, you have to chuck it all out and then start again. And I mean, I've been working on it for 2 years already.
And did you undertake it knowing, had enough people told you that when you started, you thought this will be a 2-year process? Or
yeah, it was that kind of, people would, you'd say, I'm going to do this, you know, all kind of, and they'd sort of go,
Well, I have...
We'll see you in a couple of years, you know.
Well, I look forward to it. I have a lot of confidence in you. Please don't let me down. Because
no,
that Dame Commander stuff, they can take that right away from you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I could, my badge could be
They can just show up and...
stripped of my badge.
It's such a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much for making
it.
Emma Thompson, everybody. The Children Act is available now exclusively on DirecTV and the
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm here backstage with Emma Thompson. Thank you for doing
Sarah.
This.
Hi, Sarah. Oh, you're very welcome. There's a fantastic selection of snacks here.
So you mentioned on the with Seth that Ian McEwan wrote the book and the screenplay.
Yeah.
And you had read the book before he adapted the screenplay, way before, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
And were you sort of drawn to it as soon as you read it, or was it something that you had thought about after the fact, like after the screenplay came up, remembered?
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, I wasn't reading the book and thinking of that'll make a great film at all. There was no notion of it. So it was just that I loved the book.
Yeah.
So when the screenplay came, I thought, oh, that'll be interesting. And Ian's changed it, you know, I mean, there's quite a lot of, I mean, obviously, it's a novel, so there's a, such interiority in the novel. But he'd written a really beautiful screenplay.
Yes.
So it was immediate.
And it was based on this true story.
Yes.
But Sir Alan Ward was the judge.
Yes.
And you mentioned to me that he actually was, he participated in the film in the sense that he gave you access to this world that no other film had ever gotten access
to. No, that's right. We got access to the buildings as well. But also backstage, you realise what an ancient and abstruse world this is. It's sort of slightly reminiscent of perhaps Masonic masonry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because... I mean, for example, there's red carpets back in the law courts, and only judges and their clerks are allowed to walk on those carpets. It's very hierarchical. Of course, it's one of the last and most male bastions of our systems. You know, you've got a political system, the law system of justice, and it's still very hard for women to get in there. Getting harder, actually, because of our messing about with our educational structures.
And so you mentioned to me that you made friends, actually, with two of the judges you spoke with.
Yeah.
Both female judges.
Yeah, yeah. And they were amazing women. Really heroic. I mean, superheroes to me.
Did they both have similar ways of getting to the position they were in or that you noticed, or were very different?
Yeah, I mean, what happens is, because being a judge is a public office, it's not like being a silk. You have to have been a QC, Queen's Counsel, a silk in the courts before you become a judge. So you have to have done a great deal of work, as it were, under judges, you know, and watching them. And because all judges know each other and all lawyers know their judges. So, you know, say you're doing a criminal court and you know you've got a certain judge, you'll say, oh, well, he or she is very tough on A, B, C. You know exactly what those judges are like. I mean, they're not only their personalities, but also how they're likely to respond to the case that you're presenting them. So it's quite a closed world in that sense. And I found that extremely interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The women, the capacity, the brain capacity, that what they have to be able to take in and calibrate within everything that they know to do with precedent and law, but also to do with their emotional IQ, watching these people in the courtroom and working out, you know, who's telling the truth, who isn't telling the truth. You know, they're so many different things. I mean, yes, they're lawyers and they're judges, but they're also forensic about emotional little tiny signs, because they can see. It's like a theatre, because you're up.
Yeah,
and looking down on all these people is amazing.
And they have to do that quite quickly.
Very quickly. And sometimes they have to write a judgment. Their judgments are beautiful to read. They're beautifully written. And that was the thing that drew Ian to the subject in the first place. He read a whole sheaf of judgments. And Alan's judgment on the Jehovah's Witness case, and you see Fiona writing a judgment at the beginning, and it's poetic and it's literary.
Yeah.
Deeply literary.
It must have been such a cool world to be inside
of. So cool. So cool. So interesting. And a world I couldn't possibly have entered myself. So mm-hmm. It was one of those things where I felt so fortunate to be able to pretend
Yes. That
I would have been able to do this.
Yes.
And it was very important to me to get it right so that I honoured those women, because I felt very passionately about them.
Absolutely. Well, you're wonderful in it, and thank you so much for being here.
No, not at all. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I wanted to just go on for ages, being silly, but also being serious.
You can come back anytime you would like.
Okay, thank
really,
you.
Really, even if we're booked, just
okay, I'll just clearly have someone removed mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. take their place suddenly and without warning.
It's fine.
Good.
They'll survive.
I'm in. Yeah.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.